Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. For AMC Networks, we unite Saturday night to simulcast the new nature miniseries, Seven Worlds, One Planet, and call attention to the unfolding wildfire and wildlife crisis down under. Executive producer Johnny Keeling joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. And what was the TV picture at CES last week in Las Vegas? CNET senior reporter Joel Solzman is back from Vegas and comes our way next half hour. Also ahead, a new LA diversity effort, Showtime's TCA Stop, our Critics' Choice TV Award recap, and our classic trivia question of the week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a trio of audiobooks when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Good morning, afternoon to you, and welcome once again to the program All About Television. 45 degrees at the top of the hour. Happy to have you aboard. Two wonderful guests coming your way over the next hour, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Just get interactive with us. Pick up the phone and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. You can also check us out on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com, says televised, and be involved in our chat room that you'll find there. It's Simon Apple 04 by name, so use the phone or the room. Either way, we get you involved. And while the promo is on the air, you connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk or Speaker screen. Follow the instructions, other people can be live with you. Johnny Keeney will be with us live here in the Big Apple after these news notes. Local government in Los Angeles kicked off a new initiative to increase Latino representation in TV and other entertainment media. Known as LA Collab, short for collaborative, the project will connect Latinos in front of and behind the camera to various opportunities, including TV pilot and series development at Warner Media and Pocket.Watch as well. Other companies taking part include Blumhouse Television, Bad Robot, Hello Sunshine, Reese Witherspoon's Company, and Sundance Institute. Several Hispanic advocacy groups will also participate, and LA Collab has raised $250,000 in seed funding, with more anticipated. At this hour, Showtime is near halfway of its Winter Television Critics Tour showcase in Los Angeles. The news of it so far, Shameless will end its run this summer, covering 11 seasons in all. City of Angels, the long-developed U.S.-based offshoot of Penny Dreadful, begins at last April 26th. Nathan Lane is among the stars. Second seasons are in hand for recent premieres, The L Word Generation Q and Work in Progress, both premiered last month. And Vice's Weekly New Magazine will move from HBO Late Night to Showtime's primetime schedule on March 29th, that's a Sunday night. And get ready for Three Ice, a three-on-three pro hockey league coming next summer. CBS Sports will carry selected Three Ice games in various channels starting June 2021 and offer the championship game on the CBS television network. Coming up later this hour, we'll have a recap of last night's Fifth Critics' Choice TV Awards that were presented on the CW. And it turns out that the ratings did not do as well as last year. That's coming up later this half hour. And that is news notes for now. And now joining us live here in New York is the executive producer of the new nature miniseries, Seven Worlds, One Planet, will be simulcast starting Saturday night on AMC, IFC, Sundance TV, and BBC America. We welcome executive producer Johnny Keating. Johnny, welcome in.
Hi there. How you doing?
Very, very fine, thank you. By the way, we have a person just joined to our chat room. If you have a question or comment, put it in the room and make the call at 646-652-2906. How are things going getting ready for the premiere of your program?
Oh, it's going really well. I just arrived last night in New York, and we just got some screenings tonight and then tomorrow, and then over to L.A. for a few more screenings on Wednesday and Thursday.
How is this series different from the other major BBC series that we've seen over the last decade, 15 years or so on various networks, shows like Blue Planet, Living Planet, so on?
So I worked on Planet Earth 1 and Planet Earth 2, and this series is very different. It's got new species, new behaviors, new stories. So that's one thing that's very different. I think the other thing that's different is we've broken up the planet in continents. So each episode is a single continent. There's one episode on Africa, one on South America, one on Asia. and we haven't done that before. So it means that within an episode, you get a lot of variety. Before on Planet Earth 1 and Planet Earth 2, the episodes would be mountains or jungles or deserts. And, you know, then you're, if it's the jungles program, it's going to be green throughout. Whereas this, we have a lot of different color, a lot of different animals, a lot of variety within each episode. I think the other thing that we've really moved on as well is we've moved in terms of technology. We've used a lot of drones. And so we've got a very different look to the series, and we've been able to capture behavior and take those drones to places that we wouldn't be able to take a helicopter. And I think the final thing to say is that there's the conservation in each episode as well is really prevalent. We haven't done that before in Planet Earth 1. We didn't cover conservation. And in Planet Earth 2, we only just touched on it. And now we really, this series, it has stories of both some despair and some sad stories, very real and very important. But we also have some stories of hope as well, where humans have managed to sort of turn things around, and some of the animals have kind of started to make a comeback. So it's got a lot of variety in it, and a lot of excitement, a lot of really emotionally engaging stories as well.
Did the focus on conservationism in this series, did that impact the decision to, rather than start the series on Saturday night covering North America, that's the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and so forth, to do it on Australia, given the last 2 weeks that we've all had a chance to see what's been going on with the wildfires down under?
Exactly, yeah. It's important to recognize the sort of disaster that's happened in Australia, and I think we thought it was important to start the series with that episode as a sort of, you know, as a mark of respect and as a sort of homage to the extraordinary wildlife on that continent. We're starting with Australia, and that was a decision that's only been made in the last few weeks.
And incidentally, the episode was filmed before the wildfires began. When you did shoot the episode, was there any sense that wildfires would break out in that country, in that continent?
Yeah, we finished filming it last year, and it was delivered by sort of August time, and the wildfires began sort of September, October. So we sort of missed that. But there were some indications from the scientific community, you know, even sort of 10 or more years ago, that there was a potential for wildfires, because it's been extraordinary, you know, an unprecedented year in terms of rainfall. It's been a drought year in Australia, and it's been the highest average temperature across that continent that's ever been experienced. So there were some indications, but we, across the series, we've sort of featured some stories in Antarctica, for example, are to do with climate change, but we didn't want to feature that in every single episode. So the sort of one of the conservation stories that we're covering in Australia is more about introduced species and what happens when animals come from a different place and arrive on that continent. So we haven't covered wildfires, unfortunately. But it is, across the series, each episode is both a celebration of the diversity and the variety of life in each continent, but also we cover the threats, some of the threats which are faced by those animals.
Seven Worlds, One Planet is the newest major nature miniseries from the BBC, and it's getting exposure here in the United States starting this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Pacific time on not one, not two, not three, but four networks from AMC. That's AMC, BBC America, IFC, and Sundance Television. They'll all run it in a simulcast fashion. And during the program, they'll also give you an opportunity, if you'd like to help and like to assist the people, the first responders on the ground in Australia dealing with the wildfires, and we'll give you a website that you can deal with a little bit later on in the program. Johnny Keene, he's the executive producer of the program. He's with us live from New York this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon, I'm over to you live, also from the Big Apple. If you have a question or comment for Johnny, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04. Welcome another person just came in the room, so put your thoughts in the room or make the call, and we will hear you either way. Johnny, when you have a program like this, where you devote each episode to a particular continent, how do you determine what you cover? How do you determine where you go and what wildlife you focus on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it took 4 years to make the series, so a lot of effort and a lot of consideration goes into that. But we're looking for stories, like I said, that are new. So new animals, new behaviors, new places, new ways to film things. We're also looking for stories that will be emotionally engaging and interesting. You know, I mean, sometimes you see a really interesting picture of an animal, but it's not a story. It doesn't have multiple elements, multiple beats to that story. So, and then we're looking at a good broad range. Say we're covering South America. We don't want to have everything in the Amazon or everything in the Andes or, you know, everything on the coast. You want to have a range of different locations so you feel like you've covered that continent, and that you, and the, those animals need to tell you something new and interesting about the continent as well. So once you've sort of done that, you usually end up with your sort of 9 or 10 stories. And you know, I think that within each episode we've got lots of, I'd say, lots of new and unexpected and unknown stories, lots of surprises, and some really, I hope, I mean, I think when I watch it, there's some lovely storytelling as well within each sequence that makes you really care for that animal and really, really feel for it and understand the challenges it faces. But also at the end of it, you'll hopefully come to the end of that episode and think, I know a lot more about, you know, even if it's your home continent like North America, you'll know a lot more about North America than you did at the beginning.
And incidentally, the North America segment that was going to be the opener of the program, that will be on the following week, the following Saturday. So just to let you know, it's going to be Australia first, then North America, and then the rest of the episodes as scheduled. How long did it take to film at each location?
I mean, the shortest shoot we did was probably 3 weeks, and the longest might be 3 months. So that's the sort of range. And sometimes you'd go back to a place multiple times, you know, maybe twice to get something. So we were shooting for 2 or 3 years probably in amongst those 4 years, because obviously there's some editing and post-producing to do, and there's some research to do. So research at the front and then some finishing off and doing the narration and so on at the end. But in the block in the middle is probably about 3 years worth of filming.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jerry, oftentimes when you make programs like this, because it is nature, and nature is not directable, it's not producible in the normal sense like a scripted television program. You can't tell, you know, animals or the environment what to do, what to say, you know, how you unfold. Give me an example of a situation at any of the continents that wasn't on your radar screen when you went filming and it became a story.
Oh, I mean, quite often you're going out with your sort of A-list story, the one that you really want to get, and you've storyboarded it and said, this is how it's going to happen. The animal's going to walk in here and do this. That doesn't happen, as you said. But quite often you have a backup plan as well. I'm just trying to think of an example where, we had one in North America. We went to film wolves on the coast in British Columbia, the wolves that swim between the islands. And actually the permissions were very hard to get because there was some sensitivity around being in areas where the wolves were, because there'd been reports of wolves getting very habituated to people and they were worried about wolves attacking. So we switched that. We couldn't find the wolves in the area we were looking in. There was some sensitivity as well. So we ended up filming a sequence of black bears on the coast, a mother turning over rocks and pulling out little crabs, and her baby bears as well going and copying her and doing the same thing, which has turned out to be a really sweet story. And then a male comes in and threatens them. So that was a story that turned out to be, you know, just as good and very interesting and really sweet and actually a really lovely moment and quite surprising to see bears eating crabs. But yeah, we went out with a different story in mind, and that quite often happens that you won't get exactly the story that you planned for. But I like that. It means you often get something that's kind of different and interesting, and it gives a sense that there's a realism, I guess, across the whole series that actually this is what's happening right now in those continents, rather than it being kind of CGI or you know, a drama that's planned out very carefully. I quite like that, the adventure of it, as it were.
Of the 7 continents that you went to, which was the one that you were looking forward to the most? Because either you had never gone there before, or there was something unique and special that if you had gone there before, this was the chance to see it.
So Antarctica, I'd never been to before, and I did manage to go on this trip, on this series, and go on a filming trip there, and filmed an extraordinary sequence of these penguins that it's their first time they ever swim in the ocean. Their parents have fed them up from being a chick, and then they walk down to the ocean. And as they're about to jump in, the leopard seals, which are these enormous seal predators, turn up and then try to hunt these newly fledged penguins that are jumping into the ocean. And it's a really sort of dramatic chase. And so we filmed that with using a drone, we filmed it underwater, and we filmed it from the land as well. And it turned out to be a really, really dramatic sequence. So that was quite interesting for me. I mean, some of the continents I was most excited about, I was interested in Asia because there's lots of areas that were sort of unknown, unseen, and we've got an extraordinary sequence from Iran, which is just an animal which most people wouldn't even dream existed. And when you show it to people, they think it's some sort of fake animal, and it's only just been discovered. So there's some really nice surprises in Asia. I love Europe because you think, well, I sort of know Europe. I think of that because I'm from Europe, and I think, well, there's nothing new to tell there. But we've got a really, really wonderful sequences within that episode. One of them is I had no idea, for example, that hamsters lived wild, and they live in Europe, and some of them live in the graveyards of Vienna, and we've got this amazing sequence of wild hamsters running around the graveyards of Vienna fighting because they eat the eat the flowers that people put on the graves, so graveside sort of bouquets, and they'll fight over those flowers because they want to eat them, and then they'll try and eat the candle wax, and people put kind of candles on the flower on the graves. So there's lots of really nice surprises and really unusual animals. We've got monkeys in Europe, which again, lots of people won't even know, you know, exist there. So I like some of the surprising continents like that.
As far as North America is concerned, our country or north of the border or south of the border, what did you focus on?
So we focused on Canada and on the USA. I don't think we've got any sequences in Central America at all, but we've got stories from Canada. We've got one, so polar bears. I sort of thought, well, I've been filming for 25 years. I've been a biologist, you know, for another 10 years on top of that. I know, you know, all there is to know about polar bears. I'm sure I do. And then someone came and said, I've got this amazing story, and told us this story about polar bears, which features in the North America episode, doing something I've never seen them do before. So, again, that's what I like about the series, is that we've got even the animals that are familiar are animals, they're doing things which are very surprising. So we've got polar bears in that. We've got lynx, you know, the cat, in right up in the north of Canada, hunting snowshoe hares. We've got, I mean, I don't want to spoil the whole episode for you, but there's a really nice, extraordinary sequence of fireflies. There's a fish that lives in a stream on the east of the country, on the east of the states, which does this fascinating behavior, mating behavior. And again, I'm not a big fan of fish. I sort of think they're all right, but they're just a bit sort of, you know, a bit boring and slippery. And then this fish turns up that looks like a character out of Pixar, and has a really fascinating piece of behavior, which, again, I would challenge most people don't even know exists. So, yeah, there's some really, really interesting sequences and lovely stories in the North America episode.
The opening stanza of Seven Worlds, One Planet, focusing on Australia, is this Saturday night, 9:10 Eastern Pacific Time on AMC, IFC, Sundance TV, and BBC America. And if you would like to have a direct impact on what's going on in Australia with the wildlife and wildfire crisis down there, here's what you can do. There's a special website that's now available for you that gives you links and gives you a direct way to make a difference. It's bbca.com/howtohelp. It's bbca.com/howtohelp. It'll give you direct access to information, the latest information on the crisis there, and how you can make a difference for the first responders and everybody who is involved in that situation. So once again, that website is bbca.com/howtohelp. Johnny Keeling, the executive producer of Seven Worlds, is our guest this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. He's with us live from New York, where it's 45 degrees at the top of the hour. Simon Alpha, I'm with you. Thanks for joining us here this Monday afternoon on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker for the program All About Television. If you have a question or comment on our remaining minutes with Johnny, ring them in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04. And coming up right after our interview, we'll have a recap of the Critics' Choice TV Awards, which took place last night in L.A. and was carried live on the CW. Drone technology and some of the other technology that you're using for the first time, how have they made a difference in people like yourself covering the world of nature?
Yeah, it's been revolutionary, really, for us. It's during the course of the filming, we various new drones came out and were smaller. They were quieter. They flew for longer. The lens quality is better. The camera quality is better. The stability of them is better. And so we were able to pack those up into, you know, a small suitcase and take them everywhere. So we took them down caves. We took them to the Antarctic. We took them over oceans. We flew through volcanoes at night actually as well. So we took them absolutely everywhere, and they were brilliant. And the things that they helped us do, I mean, they can get to places, both, you know, a place where you would never be able to take a helicopter normally, both in terms of you couldn't take it to that country, or you couldn't take it to that location, or you couldn't take it, you know, through the middle of a cave or something because it's so small, or through, you know, right through a jungle. So we got some really lovely shots with the drones, and it allows you to film behavior as well. Some of them are so quiet now, the animals aren't bothered by them, and you can film behavior. We've got the sequence with the polar bears actually in North America was really helped by using a drone, which we wouldn't normally, you know, you couldn't take a helicopter to that location because it was too remote, and also just hovering over the polar bears would have been too disruptive, I think. So, but with a helicopter, but actually with the drone, we were able to get the footage. So yeah, they've been brilliant for us, and it's given the series a bit of a sort of signature look, you know, being able to look top down and see a view that you wouldn't normally get.
And something else about your series that really is important is who's narrating it. He's probably the best known. He's like the Marlon Perkins of our generation when it comes to showcasing nature and the natural world on television. We're talking about, of course, Sir David Attenborough. What was it like to work with him?
Well, David is a real joy because he's 93 years old, but he still has the enthusiasm and the passion of a young boy, of a seven-year-old boy, I would say. And he has the knowledge and the wisdom, obviously, of someone who's 93. So it's an amazing experience to be able to work with him and to have his enthusiasm and his knowledge. But when he comes into the, you know, to do the voice record as well, his voice and his ability to tell a story is fantastic. You know, he can change his voice from being up to a poignant moment or to a moment of joy, or being kind of cheeky or funny or playful, or if it's a moment of awe and wonder. He's got an amazing range, better than most actors, I would say, to put that into a single word even, or even, you know, in a sentence. He can, and then he can change it in the next sentence. So he's really brilliant at that, you know. And then you just remember he is 93, and yet he's still got that vocal range and that vocal control and ability. You know, plus he's got the intellect to sort of come along and talk about the science, and that factual information, that factual integrity is really important. That we want to make sure that that we're being correct and that we're being, you know, factually right. And again, David will pull us up if he thinks something's wrong. He says, "Have you checked this?" And, you know, you do. We check everything. And sometimes he sort of says, "Well, I think this isn't quite right. You need to say it this way." So he's a real he's an amazing asset to the series.
Before I let you go, Johnny, have you been in touch with the people in Australia? How are they doing? And what do they think about the fact that what they're dealing with and the wildlife of their country is going to get the first exposure on your series?
We've been in touch with them. You know, across the series, there's about 25 of us who work on the core team, but around the world, we work with 1,500 people for this series over 4 years. And so, you know, the people in Australia, we went and as soon as the fire started, we were talking to them and asking how they were, how their families are, also how the animals are that we filmed. And all the animals that we filmed within the series are all doing okay. I mean, there's one particular one, which is a brand new species, which has only just been discovered. It's a species of spider, which has got this incredible mating behavior. So we were worried about that, you know, because it's just been discovered and it's in one small area. You don't want that area to disappear. I mean, you don't want any areas to disappear, but we were particularly worried about that. I've been filming dingoes in Australia as well, hunting kangaroos, which is the first time anyone's filmed that. And the area we filmed the dingoes in, there are fires nearby, but it's okay. And so the dingo family that we filmed is all right. But yeah, it's devastating, really. And if you think, I mean, the estimates are between 500 million or 1 billion animals, somewhere between 500 million and 1 billion animals have died during these fires. That's extraordinary. And they think that many species may well have gone extinct because they're only in little pockets of you know, remaining in pockets of forest, and those forest areas have been wiped out. So, yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Seven Worlds, One Planet, the latest of an extraordinary lineup of BBC-produced nature history miniseries, comes your way this Saturday night. Australia, the first topic, and it's on this Saturday night at 9:30 Pacific time on AMC, IFC, Sundance TV, and BBC America, which also, by the way, on Saturdays has the popular new Descartes Wonderstruck, who's executive director of BBC America, was on our show a few weeks back to talk about that, and I'm happy to say it's doing quite well. So again, Seven Worlds, One Planet, kicks off this Saturday night, 9:30 Pacific time on those four services. Check your local for where they are available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program online, go to bbcamerica.com. That's bbcamerica.com. And again, if you want more details about what is going on with the wildlife crisis in Australia and opportunities for you to help, here's where you go. Special site, bbca.com/how-to-help. That's bbca.com/how-to-help. Everyone down there dealing with that crisis will really appreciate your involvement for it. Johnny Keeley, executive producer, thank you again for being with us. Good luck with this miniseries. I have a hunch it's going to be a great winner. And all the very best to you and your crew on a wonderful new year and decade going forward.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Johnny. Take care. All the greatest.
Thanks.
Johnny Keeley, executive producer of Seven Worlds, One Planet. Join us live from New York. The series kicks off again Saturday night, 9:30 Pacific time on AMC, IFC, BBC America, and Sundance TV. Coming up, Critics' Choice TV Awards last night. We'll have a recap for you, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. One of the most interesting books available right now in audio form is Three Women by Lisa Tatum. We'll make a great miniseries, by the way, if somebody did it. Well, you can hear it for yourself and why it's getting a lot of popularity through a trial run at Audible.com. You know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. There's over 186,000 choose from. You can listen on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and, of course, iHeartRadio. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. Get three free audiobooks and that 1 month trial with great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. And don't forget, two of those free audiobooks come from the fast growing catalog of Audible Originals, original audio productions, best of Broadway, off Broadway regional theater, and great one woman and one man shows, all for you. So hear for yourself how Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. Get those three free audiobooks right now at audibletrial.com/televised. Last night, the CW presented the 25th annual Critics' Choice Awards for the Best in Film and Television. We should point out that Ed Martin, one of the people I work with at MediaVillage.com, is one of the key people at the Critics' Choice Association. And we want to give you the recap of what took place on the television side last night. First of all, the drama categories. The big winner in the series category was Succession, just like in the Golden Globes earlier this month. Best actor in a drama, Jeremy Strong for Succession. Actress in a drama, Regina King for Watchmen, which also won the Supporting Actress Award for Jean Smart. And supporting actor in a drama, Billy Crudup for The Morning Show, big surprise. And the first major award, by the way, for that Apple TV Plus original series. In the comedy categories, just like the Emmys, just like the Golden Globe, Fleabag dominated things, won Best Comedy, also won Best Actress for creator Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and supporting actor for Andrew Scott. Best Actor in Comedy, Bill Hader for Barry on HBO, and supporting actress in the comedy, Alex Borstein for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. In the limited series category, Netflix took it for When They See Us, the Ava DuVernay miniseries. Best Movie, El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie, also on Netflix. Best Actor, Gerard Zerone for his outstanding performance in When They See Us. Best Actress in the limited series of movie, Michelle Williams for Foxy Burns. She's really cleaned up on the Emmy, the Golden Globe, etc. A triple effective for her, or trifecta for her. Best Supporting Actor, Stellan Skarsgård for Chernobyl on HBO. He won the Golden Globe earlier this month for it. And Best Supporting Actress, Toni Collette for Netflix's Unbelievable. In terms of the four main service results, HBO was the big winner with 6. Netflix and Amazon tied with 4. Apple TV and FX with 1 apiece. And as far as the ratings were concerned, they were down a third from last year on the CW. So that's the recap of the Critics' Choice Awards. Took place last night in Los Angeles. And, of course, the Critics' Choice people behind the TV Critics Association tour that is going on as we speak. Showtime and Pop TV, their time in the sun over in Los Angeles. They're wrapping up their first week today. They'll start their second week of two tomorrow. And we'll continue to bring you coverage later this week and next week of more activity down there in L.A. with the winter TCA tour. Coming up in the next half hour, what kind of role do the TV play with CES before 170,000 attendees in Las Vegas last week. Joe Sullivan, the senior reporter covering all things media and technology for CNetNews.com. She's back from Vegas. She's with us coming up shortly. And also, our Clapping Trivia Question of the Week. Get your thinking caps going. You can win a prize and play before the half hour is up. It's all coming your way after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is the best internet radio in the galaxy, www.blogtalkradioandspreaker.com. Together, reaching more than 35 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out Kings in the Morning every weekday. I know you'll find a great radio with Jay King and crew. It's weekdays, 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific. Kings in the Morning, right here exclusively on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. And remember, best week to our 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half of Tomorrow We Tell Live. Well, those of you just joining us at the bottom of the hour, Simon, I'm on with you live from New York, 45 degrees here in the Big Apple. You have a question or comment for our next guest? Make it happen, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. The first big event covering television and technology this year, of course, is CES. The annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas had more than 170,000 people attending, more than 4,000 exhibitors, and a lot of media. One of those people is back with us. She's been with us before. The senior reporter for CNetNews.com when it comes to things TV, digital, and technology. Great to have with us again, Joan Salzman. Hi, Joan. Welcome back to New York.
Hey, Simon. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You're very welcome. Happy New Year and decade to you and all of your CNetNews.com crew. What was your big TV takeaway from CES last week?
That's a great question. You know, we had two keynotes by TV companies, if you want to count Quibi, the mobile short-form video service from Jeffrey Katzenberg. If you count that as TV, then we had Quibi and we had NBC Universal both giving keynotes in Vegas this last week. But, you know, I expected there to be more from them. The NBC Universal keynote, they didn't have much to talk about with their new Peacock streaming service because they're going to be having an investor meeting about Peacock specifically this week, a week after their keynote. So they didn't really have much to say on that front. And then, you know, Quibi, they gave us a look at their new technology for how they can have full screen video whenever you're watching playback on their app, regardless of your own landscape or if you're in portrait. And that was interesting to see, but I really expect, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg, he's a showman. I expected him to really blow my hair back, and they didn't really have anything stunning to announce.
Mm-hmm. Some people are saying coming off CES that Quibi is not going to make it as just a mobile-only service. At some point, they're going to have to maybe use smart TV sets or smart devices or cable or other ways to get distributed. Are you getting that sense as well?
You know, it'll be interesting to see. They're really doing something that nobody else in streaming is doing, which is saying we're going all in on mobile. We're not necessarily going to let you stream to a television or anything else. Now, televisions are where people watch 70%, two-thirds, depending on the service, of things like Netflix, Hulu, Disney+. Across all those services, the majority of people are watching that television programming on the biggest screen they have, the television. So it seems like Quibi might be leaving a bunch of viewership and demand on the table by only going with mobile. But, you know, nobody else has really gone all in on this short-form, high-end programming concepts yet. So it's kind of uncharted territory. Now, I did talk to Meg Whitman at CES about this Samsung Cero TV. Have you heard of this? It's a television that you put on your wall, but it rotates between landscape and portrait mode. I asked her about that, and I said, well, what about a TV like that, one that acts like a mobile device in terms of rotating? And she kind of smiled, and she said, well, maybe they could. So I don't think that they're so hardcore into mobile that they wouldn't consider other options. But for the moment, for the time being, they're only going in on mobile, none of those big screens.
Joan, going into CES, some of us had the thought that this would be a great opportunity for the smart TV sets and for the smart TV makers to showcase what they are doing, to showcase the latest smart TV applications, showcase the latest smart TV features, show our artificial intelligence, which I understand was a big, big subject at CES this year, how it's incorporated television sets and products like Amazon Fire TV so that you can do all sorts of things with your voice, with the set. Everything from order products and services to controlling other aspects of your home or apartment. And the sense you got was that wasn't what was talked about. It was more when the smart TV set makers and device makers had their time at press conferences or panel sessions, it was all about picture quality, rollable sets, foldable sets, as you said, sets that go every which way on the wall. It seemed that that was the thing to avoid. What was your sense about that?
Yeah, you know, the streaming device makers, you know, talking about, like you said, Amazon Fire TV and others, they were present at CES this year, but they definitely weren't out there to talk and get their name out and brag about new features or anything like that. They were definitely taking a more subdued role in CES, kind of having some press meetings here and there, I'm sure having some meetings with partners in the background, behind closed doors. They didn't come to impress at CES this year, but they certainly have made that the point of past years in CES. Maybe this is just a year where they don't have a lot to talk about. And, you know, in the conversations that I did have with those streaming hardware makers, they did talk about how, you know, right now we're in this moment where we have traditional hardware makers launching streaming services, when you're talking about Apple TV, going into Apple TV Plus. And so there's more of a conversation about who's going to be building the platform, whether it's based on a hardware or based on a software, who's going to be building the platform that people go to as their one place to find whatever they need to stream. And so we're still really early in the days of that fight. I think that might be why there wasn't a lot of talk from those hardware makers at CES this year. It's because everyone's kind of trying to stake out their own turf and figuring out where the fronts of that battle are going to be.
How long do you think it's going to take before they sort things out, especially if you're going to see more in terms of interactivity, more in terms of incorporating features where you can control your room temperature or order products and services or see who's at the front door or use a service like Portal TV, which is already becoming more and more of a smart TV device as time goes on?
Yeah, I think it's going to still take a long time. You know, when we're especially talking about integrated home where you have, you know, light bulbs and doorbells and fridges that are connected maybe to a centralized hub that all feeds back to the biggest screen in the house, television, it's going to take a long time for that kind of consumer traction, for that, you know, that universe of devices, for consumers to really accept those things in order to demand to have a one size fits all hub to control it all. So I think if we're talking in terms of like that Internet of Things, that smart home integration with smart televisions, it's still a long way out to have an idea of who's going to be the company that delivers to the masses, because we just aren't at a point where the masses need any sort of delivery of that kind of convenience yet. But I do think that I think the thing we're going to see sooner than that kind of smart home integration is we're going to be seeing people scrapping and fighting over, you know, who's going to be the one place you go to figure out, is the thing I want to watch on Netflix? Is it on Apple? Is it on Disney Plus? They're going to be really figuring out, trying to stake their own claim over that consumer and that video viewer over the next couple years.
Irene Jones-Feldman, she is CNET's senior reporter for things TV, technology, digital, etc. Just got back from the CES event in Las Vegas last week, and she's with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised here in New York. Simon Appel will be live also from the Big Apple. If you have a question or comment for Joan, make the call and make you happen, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Two interesting developments at CES caught my attention. One was word from LG and a company called The Take that they're going to introduce a venture called Shoppable TV, where you're going to be able to order on the spot products that are showcased on either individual shows or individual networks. And it's going to be either through your television set or possibly through your cable set-top box. Did that get any traction at the show after LG announced it?
You know, actually, that's the first that I've heard about it. So, but the thing about CES is it's such a circus. So much stuff gets lost in the noise. It's totally possible that was something that, you know, made a real kind of flap over in some corners of the show and didn't make it over to whatever corners I were. But the thing I will say about Shoppable TV, it'll be interesting to see how that rolls out. You know, ever since Amazon launched its Fire TV product in coordination with also having their streaming service, Prime Video. Too many services, too many products. But yeah, coordinating Prime Video with Fire TV, there was always kind of the suspicion that this would be the prime candidate for making a shoppable streaming video service. And, you know, we haven't really seen that happen. And if anybody knows how to do shopping, it's Amazon. I think that right now, people aren't necessarily, unless they're watching QVC, unless they're watching programming designed for shopping, consumers aren't super interested in taking themselves out of the narrative of a unscripted or scripted show and putting themselves into a consumer mindset. You know, people talking, you know, like Brad Pitt goes across the screen and he's diving from an explosion. And you're like, oh, that watch. I'd really like to buy Brad Pitt's watch. I don't think we're really at a point where people have started to click that that's the way they want to shift their mindset out of entertainment and into consuming and shopping. It'll be interesting to see how this LG partnership plays out. You can tell me, is it kind of structured in a way that's designed around a QVC sort of online shopping thing, or is it more kind of an integrated interactive, like click here or move your remote here to buy whatever's on the screen sort of thing?
Well, what I understand, Joan, it's an interactive environment. It's going to involve various networks. I understand that WarnerMedia is involved, that NBC Universal is involved. A number of other programmers are involved. They also mentioned that a major cable operator is going to put this in a means of set-top boxes this fall. And it sounded like it was going to be both network and individual shows. What individual shows, we don't know yet, and it was going to take off this spring. The other thing that was interesting was Amazon Fire TV saying, we're going to allow cable operators to sell our plug-ins and our streaming sticks, and we're going to also become an operating system and other TV sets, as well as in cars.
Yeah. They're really interested in automobiles. I think, you know, it's all this movement towards away from MVPDs, you know, cable companies and satellite companies as the providers of the programming, the bread and butter programming that people get, into streaming services. And so it makes sense that as networks become less resistant to the idea of having kind of their channel available over streaming, it makes sense that they would allow hardware like Fire TV to be able to stream from their kind of authenticated app if that's what's happening. It makes sense, you know, we're just seeing this breakdown of the cable relationship with programmers, and so I think that's going to manifest in ways like this and others.
Yeah. Was Porno TV from Facebook there, and also Food Network Kitchen, two of the interactive ventures that have started in the last couple of months?
Yeah. So were they at CES? I don't remember. This is the thing about CES. So much happens. Were they there?
I don't know. That's the thing. I would have thought that Porno TV from Facebook, which started out as a video chat service and now is doing augmented reality on the television set, which is quite amazing. First time ever. Remember, we had the thought it was all maybe out on TV. I've been saying for years, put on the TV set, you don't need glasses, you don't need hardware or goggles or helmets, and they're able to do it. And the more you read about Portal TV, you get the sense that they want to be a smart TV service. They're going to put television networks on the service, other applications too. And in the case of Food Network Kitchen, we're hearing a lot about what they're doing with the television set. They're expanding what they're doing. And by the way, both of these efforts have major campaigns on television that really have gotten the attention of the public. Food Network has the kitchen, has the app, the ads running all over the place on ESPN, other cable networks, and Portal TV has those Muppet ads, which you're seeing all over the place that are very, very, I think, some of the best Muppet stuff I've seen on television in a long time.
Yeah, I would love to see the kind of device footprint that Portal has, because it's been a hard pitch to consumers to let them put, you know, we've had Facebook has been under privacy scandals for going on 2-3 years now. And so the pitch of Facebook Portal is like, yeah, we're that company that nobody feels comfortable with anymore, but why don't you let us put a camera that's always watching you inside of your bedroom or your living room? And so I feel like it was just a really hard pitch for consumers to buy the Portal. But I do think that's, in a way, it's a shame that the Portal's being made by Facebook, because it's doing, like you said, a lot of interesting, innovative things that either others have tried and not succeeded, or people haven't really tried at all. I think the Food Network partnership, having that screen with cooking programming that caters to the kind of device that's sitting right there on somebody's kitchen counter, I think that's really interesting and a kind of partnership you couldn't really see from other hardware and programming coordination before. But I don't know. I haven't heard anything about how many portals Facebook has sold, which usually means they haven't sold a lot. So I don't know. That's one of those things. It's a really great idea, but if nobody's got the device to use it, then there's not far that it can go.
Yeah. By the way, Corey Scott, too, just joined our chat room. Thank you, Corey, for coming aboard. You have a question or comment, put in the room, or give us a call, 646-652-2906. One other thing about CES was that this was supposed to be the coming-out party for next-gen television. Broadcast stations deploying ATSC 3.0 in at least 60 markets around the country. How big a deal was that, next-gen television in Vegas?
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about that at all at CES. It's possible that I wasn't going to the right panels, that I wasn't taking the right meetings, but literally nobody was talking to me about that, which is interesting. I think that Amazon, I've heard that Jeff Bezos is really interested in the device that they have, the Recast device, which is like a combination antenna and DVR device that allows you to grab over the air signals for television networks and basically store them as a DVR, and then you can also have other things streaming to it that are based off the internet. I've always thought that that's a really – I've heard that it's the device – at least within the last year, I've heard it's the device that Jeff Bezos is most excited about that Amazon's making. And I've also, I think that some of that has to do with the next-gen TV stuff that's going to be happening. But, I didn't really hear anything about it. It's possible that it's something that's so inside the television broadcast industry that it doesn't really show up at CES, which is so focused on consumer hardware, or it's possible that those are the kind of things that people are still in the early stages of figuring out how to leverage it into interesting consumer technology that it's going to be next year or the year after that it really gets discussed at CES.
Yeah, certainly one thing to follow. Two other things of thought. One, I thought interactive television did not get the attention at CES it should have gotten because of the smart TV, because of AI and the television set, because of Food Network Kitchen, Portal TV, Echo, which apparently did not show up at the Samsung interactive venture that at some point may be a television venture. We don't know yet. It just seemed that that was on the radar. And the second thing is that it seemed there was more talk about plant-based foods than there was about television. I would see all these stories, including some from CNET, about impossible foods, instituting pork and plant-based scallops and shrimp. I mean, I just had my first Impossible Burger, by the way, over the weekend at Five Napkin, the restaurant chain in Manhattan, Five Network Burger. And I got to tell you, I love the Impossible Burger. I'm still waiting for Burger King to couple the Impossible Whopper in my neighborhood in Brooklyn so I can try that out. But it's tasty.
Yeah, you liked it. That's great. Yeah, Impossible has become this sort of like out of nowhere buzzy thing from CES last year into this year. Last year was when they announced this Impossible Burger 2.0 at CES, and this year they came back announcing their Impossible Pork and Sausage that's going to be coming out this month and later. And it's turned into something that's kind of an obsession. It's one of the few technologies at CES that doesn't have any. There's no silicon, there's no wires, there's no plugs. It's just like some lab-generated fake meat. But it really gets people interested. And I'd be curious if you have any thoughts about why. I have some suspicions about why people are so fascinated with it. I'd be curious if you have any ideas about why it captures the imagination so much.
Maybe part of it is that it going in an environment of purpose, it saves animals' lives. It's a great way to use plants, especially soy, and because of the taste. That the taste is not when vegan food came out, a number of years ago, there was some criticism about the taste, and it seems that the initial reaction, including from some of your people who tested it, is that the taste is really good. Like, it tastes like shrimp. It tastes like pastrami. It tastes like sausage. I've had the tofurkey Italian-based sausages for the last few months at one of my local stores, and it's great. Tastes like Italian sausage, really good. Put ketchup on, have it on a roll or have it plain. It works well. Anyway, so going forward from CES, what's on your radar? So you mentioned Peacock, which is, of course, is having their Investor Day on Thursday. By the way,
one other
thing, Paley Center is going to have their Best of CES event on Thursday night. So, Paley folks, bring that Impossible. They were at Impossible Foods last year. Bring them back this year. Bring in those sliders, whatever. But anyway, what's your thoughts about what's on your radar screen aside from Peacock and what else?
Well, yeah, so we've got Peacock later this week. Just in terms of what I'm paying attention to, we got Peacock this week, and then we're going to have Netflix is going to report their earnings on, I think, Tuesday, a week from Tuesday. That'll be the day after, I think, the holiday. And, then, you know, the reason I think that that's interesting, it's not necessarily TV news. It kind of goes across both TV and film. But, you know, this will be their end-of-year holiday season report. And the holidays are when they have the most binging going on of any other point in the year. The holidays are when they usually have those sort of standout titles. Last year it was Bird Box when they had the 80 million people, 80 million accounts stream that within 4 weeks, according to their data that they released without, you know, any kind of third-party vetting. But, you know, it is that's what they say. You know, that happened last year, and so it'll be really interesting to see if there was any sort of standout title from this last holiday break, whether it was Witcher, they promoted that very heavily, or something else. It'll be interesting to see what kind of statistics and nuggets they want to drop to, you know, impress people about one of their titles, what title that might be. So that's going to be coming up. We got Peacock this week. We've got Netflix the week after that. And then it's not so much a big thing in the TV world, but it kind of ventures into TV. Sundance kicks off at the end of next week. So that's the next place on my travel docket is going to Park City to see what people have got in store there.
One thing I'm concerned about is that all these mega programming services, Peacock, HBO Max last year, and so forth, are being introduced in investor conferences and not with press events. And I thought Discovery, by the way, made a big error by not doing Food Network Kitchen the same way. They did an investor call, not a media call. Has there been any thought about Comcast or other people involved in these ventures doing a media day, similar to what goes on with the TCA tour, where you can see in New York the talent and whatever else, you know, whatever the services are at, so we all get a sense of what's going on?
Yeah, I haven't gotten a sense of that. It looks like I think Disney sort of laid out the game plan for how these things go, Disney being the first one to sort of do this thing, have this sort of launch playbook. And it seems to be you really release the most information with this investor day that's catered to investors and Wall Street analysts and press. They definitely invite a lot of press to those too. It's definitely different than a TCA sort of thing. My gut is that as they announce this original programming, that these services are just going to start showing up at these TCA things. They're not going to, you know, kind of invent their own or reinvent the wheel in order to get that sort of publicity out in front of press in that manner. I think didn't Apple have like a whole bunch of stuff at TCA in this last go around? You would know better than me. Did Apple TV Plus do something at TCA?
I've heard that they will have the last day.
They have the last day. Yeah, I heard something about
they will have the last day at this one.
Yeah, they'll have the last day
at this one a week from now. And they will certainly have a lot to crow about because of how the morning show has done, where it's gone from being the undarling of people to the darling of people, gaining the Golden Globe nomination. And of course, last night, Billy Crudup won for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy. That's the first award that a Apple TV Plus show has gotten.
Yeah. Apple TV Plus has got a hard road with the fact, you know, they only launched with 9 titles, and now it's expanded to something like 15, maybe, if you include movies. It's no more than that. It's a hard road when you're launching a service into this market where you've got people that have, you know, like the HBO Maxes and the Disney Pluses, and soon we'll know exactly what kind of programming slate Peacock has when they've got, you know, thousands of episodes and hundreds of movies, and it's a hard path to kind of cut for yourself when you don't have a lot of program. But maybe that'll give you a better window into how these services really get in front of the presses with Apple's press day, with their press presence at TCA. That should maybe that'll start to set a precedent.
Yeah, it'd be great also if all of these folks did something in New York as well as LA. And
I know.
And this, by the way, when Apple TV came out, the day of launch, I criticized them for not using their Apple stores, not ringing the bell at the stock exchanges, not being on shows like Squawk Box or Bloomberg Technology, et cetera, to talk about what was going on. But it's interesting that at least in the Apple Store and the World Trade Center, they are showing Apple TV Plus now. They are finally doing it. And maybe that's something all the other stores would do. Before you go, I've watched you before on some of the programs like Squawk Box and Bloomberg Challenge and so forth, and I get this sense from people that they're sensing that Netflix has become an underdog, that with BET Plus and Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus and so on, that Netflix is going to be sort of the Netflix get killed. And I'm wondering if we're all underestimating the kind of infrastructure that Netflix is getting, and also the fact that now they're releasing shows left and right. It's not no longer releasing a show every 2.5 weeks or two
right.
weeks or just on a Friday. They're releasing shows left, right, and center. And it's amazing, for example, The Witcher you mentioned, which has become a mega hit for them. And they've already released in less than 15 days 4 scripted series, 2 unscripted, a movie or two, and it seems that some of them must be taken. Are we all underestimating how Netflix is going to go in this mega era?
Yeah, I think anybody that's underestimating Netflix hasn't, you know, kind of taken it, whatever goggles they're wearing, they haven't taken them off to just take a real clear look at the playing field. You know, Netflix has more than 150 million members globally, which is more than anybody else can really brag about in the market that they're in right now. It's, of course, whenever you have names like HBO and Disney and NBC Universal getting into the streaming market, that's going to give a sense of sort of foreboding competition for Netflix. But, you know, just Disney, for example, they're starting out in the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and Canada. And the vast majority of the membership that they're getting is based in the U.S. That's the biggest market that they're in compared to those other ones. The rest of the services, they're not even really considering international expansion until much, much later. They haven't really defined those plans. And I think that just goes to show, you know, Netflix is in every country except for China. They have a really big head start, not only in geography, but also just that pure number of members that nobody else can really match. And that's not even touching on the fact that they've got this incredible machine of content already churning things out on a seemingly, you know, multi-title a day basis. It's so hard to keep up with. And it's, you know, we've got, when you're talking about Disney and Warner Media and NBC Universal, they're making a lot of content as well that's not necessarily destined first for their streaming service. But when you're thinking in terms of streaming service competition, you have to be thinking in terms of what's going there, what's ending up there. So even though Disney is ruling the box office, it takes time for those box office blockbusters to make it to Disney Plus, and therefore consumers don't necessarily think about Disney Plus as the first and only place to get, you know, the next Marvel movie, whichever one it is in their cycle that's coming out next. I can't keep track. But yeah,
for
I think
sure.
anyone that's underestimating Netflix is probably in for a rude awakening.
Yeah. And on that note, we will leave things there. You want to know, want to have more of Joan's wonderful reporting, check out news.com. It's cnetnews.com, available on lots of places along the web. www.news.com. You'll be well rewarded. Joan, thank you again for all the post-CS thoughts. It's always a pleasure. Happy New Year and decade to you and your crew, and let's have you back soon.
Thanks, Simon. Back to you.
You got it. See you along the trail. Take care. Joan Sosman from CNNNews.com joining me here in New York. We don't have time, unfortunately, for the Clapper Trivia question, so watch tomorrow on Facebook and Twitter for the question and how you can play in for the win. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not those of the Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Sosman, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of Enterprise, Al Levy, and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow we televise is brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For 3 free audio books and 1 month trial, audibletrial.com/televised. But for more televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Thanks to both of our guests. Remember, if you want to help the people dealing with the wildlife and wildfire crisis in Australia, bbca.com/howtohelp. Well, thank you for your listening. We'll be back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, the Hour Radio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to between now and then, make it safe and make it great. Of course, until next time, stay well and stay tuned.